This is a production from the Yak Podcasting Network. The home for your growing sonic map of local voices united in their commitment to the best in podcasting.
This Texas baseball team just keeps finding a way to win games. And my man Mike Trout is about to get paid. Yo, welcome back. It's another edition of the Extra Bases Podcast on theyak.com. I'm Dustin McComas from orangewoods.com, and we are up to 33 of these bad boys. 33 is also my age. I had a Larry Bird birthday back in October. I like to, you know, when you get older, I like to assign birthdays by, like, former or current big-time athletes. Kind of makes you feel a little bit younger, and I know 33 is still young, but once you get over 30, it's kind of a weird feeling. But anyway, Texas baseball team coming off of a huge series win at home against Texas Tech. We'll dive into that here shortly in a little bit. In some ways, it's kind of hard to explain how they won that series. And then big news broke in Major League Baseball today from ESPN's Jeff Passan. Mike Trout agreeing to a 12-year, $430 million extension with the Los Angeles Angels. I think they dropped the of Anaheim, or maybe they didn't. I'm not really sure. But the LA Angels, the team that Mike Trout has been playing on, the team that drafted him as a high school guy out of Millville, New Jersey, is going to lock him up basically for his entire career. So we'll dive into that as well, because if you know me, if you ever followed my work at orangewoods.com or follow me on Twitter, I'm sure I've mentioned it 10 times in previous Extra Bases podcasts. I'm a big Mike Trout guy. I would say that he is my favorite professional athlete, probably by far, which is weird because I'm not really an Angels fan, although I follow them closely because of Trout. But he's just, I don't know why, I can't really explain it. Just developed a huge fandom for Mike Trout early on in his career as he's blossomed into the best player in baseball. It could blossom into the best baseball player we've ever seen. So we'll dive into Trout's value in this contract and things like that later in this podcast. But let's start with the Longhorns. They opened Big 12 play this past weekend against Texas Tech, a really, really good Texas Tech team that I think after getting an up-close view of them, their lineup top to bottom was better than LSU's. I mean, LSU's was, I think, stronger 1-4. I mean, they had some guys at the top of that lineup that were really, really good. But Texas Tech's lineup 1-8, I say 1-8 because their catcher in the 9-hole couldn't hit. I mean, they pinch hit for him sometimes. They sacrifice bunted him with one out one time late in the game on Sunday. He's clearly an out, but he gives them something behind the plate. Their 1-8 was really good. I mean, they had some guys that could mash. Not the best bodies sometimes throughout the lineup. You know, their left fielder can really, really mash. But, man, if he's got to run down a fly ball, it could be an absolute adventure out there in left field. But I thought that that lineup top to bottom was better than LSU's, which probably makes it one of the best lineups in the country, I think. And I think that they're going to score a lot of runs this season. And for Texas to hold that lineup to just 9 runs over 3 games, and then you factor in, you know, all of the walks and things like that, pretty incredible job by the Texas pitching staff. A pitching staff that you could say that, you know, Bryce Elder was good, but he wasn't at his best. The bullpen was good, but it wasn't at its best. I think Blair Henley was really, really good and at his best. Sunday's game was just a total mix and match mess that included so many walks. So in a lot of ways, this Texas pitching staff didn't perform up to the level it's capable of. But the most important thing it did, and this is a theme for the Texas team as a whole, is they competed. You know, when times got tough and there's situations where they had to make big pitches and had to get outs and just had to attack and remain confident, they did that. And I really think that this Texas team won this series because of its competitiveness, because of its toughness, because of its mental makeup, because it wasn't good. In Saturday's game, they only had one hit. And through the first 5 innings on Sunday, they didn't have a hit. So for 14 innings, they basically had one hit, and they still managed to win the series. The only way you can explain that, I think, is just this team just competes. And we've seen that throughout most of the season already. It really hasn't dipped, but for a couple of occasions here or there, this team really competes. It's got good mental makeup. It never feels like it's out of a game. It's got good camaraderie. guys are pulling for each other. And I think a terrific example of this was when Bryce Regan came off the bench in the eighth inning of Sunday's game against Texas Tech. And he makes a terrific read on a ball that's in the turf. They call it a dirt ball read, but, you know, Texas doesn't have dirt, which that's another discussion for another day. But he makes a really good read on a ball down in the turf and aggressively takes second base. Barely got in there. And it was a huge play because he eventually scores on a single to give Texas a much-needed insurance run, put them up 4-1. Well, in the top of the ninth inning, Josh Young, who's, you know, a preseason All-American, one of the best college hitters in the country, gets something to hit and smashes a two-run bomb to make it a 4-3 game. And it's just Texas did a lot of those little things in the game, you know, just finding ways to just scrap and claw and push runs across or get outs. You know, the double steal when Texas finally broke through in the game and ended up scoring three runs. The double steal. So Michael McCann is in an 0-2 count against John McMillan on the mound, who can throw up to 97, 98 miles an hour and has a really good breaking ball. I mean, when he throws strikes, he's tough to handle, especially on right-handers. So McCann gets down the count 0-2. And as much of a integral part of this team as Michael McCann is, you know, they really, really need him to stay healthy behind the plate. And, you know, he's a veteran player and he's a fifth-year senior and all of those things. I don't mean to disrespect Michael McCann, but he's never been known for his bat. He's not a guy that you really teams fear when he steps into the batter's box. He was going to be a backup this season for a reason. He hits in the bottom of the lineup, whatever. So he's down 0-2 in the count, and there's a very good chance that he's going to strike out. So Texas, in an 0-2 count, which is a prime breaking ball count, it's an opportunity where you think a guy is either going to extend, you know, get out of the zone with a fastball, or he's going to throw a breaking ball out of the zone and try to get swing and miss. Well, Texas puts on a double steal, and they get a breaking ball down. A tough pitch to catch. The catcher rushes the throw. He throws it down there. The third baseman can't scoop it, and it leads to runs. Because of the double steal being put on, of course, McCann strikes out on the next pitch, but Texas is able to push across more runs to further, you know, increase its lead. And that was a big deal. I mean, they did the little things. And, you know, I went back and forth with some guy on Twitter about, oh, you know, the Cardinal sent a baseball, making a third out of third. Yeah, that's correct. But at some point, there are good gambles. That was a good gamble by Texas. McCann was in an 0-2 count. He was probably going to strike out. He was clearly overmatched by the guy on the mound. They put some things in motion, forced Texas Tech to make a play. It didn't make a play, and it led to a run. And the catch and throw, you know, caught stealing is not the given in college baseball that it is in pro baseball. So this Texas team just really, really competes. I mean, that's really the only way you can explain how that they were able to beat a really, really good Texas Tech team, take two out of three from them to open Big 12 play. And it's a huge series win for conference play, because I think that Texas Tech, if you look at all the teams in the Big 12 right now, I think that Texas Tech is probably the team besides Texas. I think you could put those both on even playing field right now. I'd say besides Texas, Texas Tech is the team best suited to win the conference. It just, if you look at the way Baylor's had some injuries, TCU is scuffled a little bit, but I really like their starting pitching, and it's going to win them a lot of games in the Big 12. Other than that, though, I mean, Oklahoma and Oklahoma State are solid, but I don't know that they're big-time conference title contenders yet. West Virginia's got a really, really good Friday night game that's going to keep them in a lot of series, but I don't think that they're a true conference title contender. So if you're Texas, opening Big 12 play with a win over Texas Tech in a series, that's huge. That's huge as it comes, you know, standings time down the stretch or tiebreakers or all those things. To start Big 12 by winning a rubber match at home Sunday against Texas Tech was a big deal, because, again, Texas almost got no hit on Saturday. Really didn't perform very well at the plate all weekend. I thought Friday that their at-bats were better than the box score, and I thought that they started to get rewarded for that later in the game. Saturday couldn't really say that. And for much of Sunday, you couldn't say that either until the final innings, when they kind of woke up and found a way to win. So, and really just getting back to this pitching staff, Texas used let me carry some ones here. Da, 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 da. They used seven pitchers in Sunday's game against Texas Tech because seven pitchers combined to walk nine guys. Nine guys. And yet Texas only gave up three earned runs, struck out seven, gave up eight hits. Texas Tech had the leadoff man on in eight of nine innings. So these pitchers were pitching on the stretch all game. They were pitching in situations where they had to strand runners, all those things. And it just gets back to that competitiveness in the depth of that bullpen. Just guys getting on the mound ready to attack. And you got Colby Kubicek coming in the ninth inning after Matt Whalen gives up the home run to Josh Young with no outs. Whalen, by the way, you know, I know he gave up two earned runs, but the job he did in the innings before that was huge. Pitching out of multiple jams, straining some runners. He's just another guy that just he competes, he attacks. So Kubicek comes in. He's only thrown five innings this season. Really had never pitched in a situation like that. You know, up by a run in the ninth inning against Texas Tech with a series victory on the line. And he got a little help from his defense on the final play of the game with Eric Kennedy making a nice sliding grab. But he challenged guys. He came in. He challenged guys, he attacked, he threw strikes. I mean, he fell behind 3-0 to Cameron Warren, who's a really good hitter, really good college hitter, and comes back with three really good fastballs. I mean, lively sinking fastballs, 92 miles an hour, good angle to him. He gets a strikeout there. I mean, the bullpen is just kind of filled with these guys. And as Sunday showed, David Pierce, I wouldn't call it a luxury because he doesn't want to be in that situation where he's having to use that many pitchers, but he does have the opportunity to be very, very aggressive with his pitcher usage if things just aren't going well. You know, Coy Cobb only lasted 2 1/3. You know, Ty Madden, we'll get to him in a little bit, only lasted three batters for injury reasons. Mateo Boki, one inning. Tristan Stevens, 1 1/3. Mason Bryant, 2/3. Whelan, two innings. And then Kubicek, the inning at the end. If they need to piece it together in those situations, you just gotta use everything you got. Texas has the ability to do that. You know, it's not always going to be Friday night where Cam Fields gets a lead after Ty Madden's the bridge guy following Bryce Elder. And Cam Fields is sensational to end the game. By the way, guys are only hitting, players are only hitting 0.51 against Cam Fields this season. That's outstanding. And 7 2/3 of his innings have come at Rice, at Stanford, versus LSU, and versus Texas Tech. So that's basically three top 10, top 15 teams, and then going on the road and playing at Rice. That's really impressive stuff. And his numbers would look even better if he didn't have to pitch in that monsoon Sunday at Stanford. So he was really, really good. Finished Friday's game with three shutout innings, three perfect innings. The slider late was really good. The fastball early was good. At Stanford, the changeup was good on Friday. You're starting to see him grow up more. You're starting to see him be able to make adjustments on the mound to understand, hey, when this isn't working, I've got to do this or I've got to make this adjustment. You know, he talked about taking some off of the slider. He was throwing the slider 85, 86 early in his outing Friday against Texas Tech. Well, in his final inning, he was 83, 84, had much better break, much better shape, had that true slider action that generated some swings and misses. So you're starting to see some of those guys grow up even more in the bullpen. But really, it all just gets back to competitiveness for Texas. They could have played better. But they've found a way to win games. And that's something that this team has proven able to do throughout the season, even in the face of adversity. And let's not, I've gotten, you know, deep into this podcast already, and I haven't mentioned one of the bigger storylines for Texas coming out this weekend, is it played good defense. It made some really high-quality plays in the outfield. It made high-quality plays on Sunday's game. I mean, the relay throw from Mason Hibler into home plate in the second inning was perfect and nailed a guy. You know, there was a lot of clean baseball being played on defense by Texas. Hibler did a good job defensively at shortstop. He was also Sunday's hero with the way he was swinging the bat. So Texas, I mean, defense was really the big issue heading into the series for Texas. And they played better defense than Texas Tech, a team that entered the series with something like only 12 or 13 errors and a fielding percentage near 980. And defense ended up being a big deciding factor in Friday's game when Ryan Reynolds hit that very hard ground ball at Josh Young and he booted it and two runs scored. Two runs that were in position by Texas being aggressive and trying to scratch and claw claw runs out any way that they can. So the defense was a big plus for Texas this weekend. Offensively, I've mentioned this before. This lineup has a chance to be solid. A little less so now because DJ Petrinsky's not in it. I think that guy had a chance to be their best hitter this season, especially with the way he swung the bat in the fall. So that definitely takes away some from the depth and the potential of the offense. But I still think that top to bottom, this lineup has a chance to be competitive, to at least be solid. I don't think it has the talent to be a good lineup. I don't think it has the talent to consistently beat really good pitching like it saw at Stanford and at times against Texas Tech and LSU. And, you know, as a team now, Texas is down to 249 batting average, 363 on base, 352 slugging. So I don't think it can get worse than that. You got to keep in mind that, again, Texas played four games against on the road at Stanford, who's one of the best pitching staffs in the country. LSU had a bunch of power arms. Texas Tech had some good arms. Texas Tech's bullpen was lights out, man. I knew they blew the game. Well, technically blew the game on Sunday. But, man, they had some guys coming out of the bullpen that could really, really throw the shit out of the ball. Have some really good breaking balls as well. So Texas has been tested by a lot of good pitching staffs. I think Louisiana's pitching staff is better than its lineup. And I think is a pretty solid pitching staff as well. But the Texas offense is going to do this at times, especially when some of its better players are either experiencing bad luck, like Austin Todd and Mason Hibler to an extent, and then guys like Duke Ellis that are times just not right. I know he's got the 26 walks, but he's now up to 25 strikeouts, and he's really struggling to get the barrel to big-time velocity or fastballs up in the zone. He's got to make an adjustment there. Zach Zubia has had some bad luck, but he's also not quite looked like an impact hitter consistently yet. It's putting a lot of pressure on guys like Eric Kennedy, who's a freshman. Ryan Reynolds is down to 288 now and kind of feels like he's sacrificing, power to generate some contact. So the lineup needs to improve. There's going to be series where they're going to have games where they don't hit. I just think that's just a factor of the talent top to bottom and missing guys like Hamilton and Petrinsky. But I do think that they can be a solid lineup. I do think that what you saw Sunday, what you saw Friday, just the competitiveness and the ability to try to force the issue to score runs any way possible, whether it's putting guys in motion, whether it's bunting, whether it's the clutch hit here or there, where it's stealing a bag, whatever it is, they can do that. And I think the most importantly about when it comes to offense is how many runs are you scoring per game? That's the most important thing as it relates to offense, more so than any other statistic, is can you generate runs on a consistent basis? And right now, Texas is at 5.68 runs per game. Anything above 5, I think, is above average. Once you start getting to that 6 range, that's a place where you can win baseball games, especially if you have the pitching staff that Texas has. And its pitching staff, after facing another lineup that's one of the best in the country, 2.97 team ERA, 0.207 batting average against, 189 strikeouts in 191 innings. If they don't walk guys, it's a good pitching staff. And speaking of that pitching staff, again, you're listening to the Extra Bases podcast on theyak.com. I'm Dustin McComas from orangebloods.com. We are going through Texas baseball right now after its series victory over Texas Tech, heading into a double midweek, series against Arkansas beginning Tuesday night at the Dish, and then another game on Wednesday. Ty Madden left Sunday's game with a shoulder injury. We haven't been given further details about that injury. His velocity's been down for a little while. I mean, this is a guy that I saw was up to 98 miles an hour in the fall. He's up to 96 miles an hour when I saw him as a high school senior in a start late in the season. He's been as high as, I think, 94 or 95 earlier in outings of season. And I know that he was kind of pulling back some to generate more command and movement and just as he's learning how to pitch and how to use his body at this level. So I wasn't immediately alarmed by the dip, but he didn't top at more than 88 miles an hour on Friday. And then his last pitch Sunday was 86. I think he was 86 to 90. For a guy that, as I've said, I think that has so much velocity in the tank, the Friday outing to me was kind of like, that's not where he should be. I mean, you're coming out of the bullpen, you're more likely to blow it out and just let it all hang and have big velocity as opposed to being down. So when he only was touching 88, and I was like, something might be up. Well, Sunday he throws a pitch 86 miles an hour, and he steps off the mound in some discomfort, and the training staff and David Pierce come out and pull him out of the game. It is a shoulder issue. We don't know exactly what it is. From my view in the press box, I was worried because it looked like he was kind of signaling or looking towards his elbow and forearm, which are clear signs of a UCL injury, which will require Tommy John surgery. So the shoulder could be a big sigh of relief. Maybe it's just some fatigue. Maybe it's just some inflammation. Maybe it's just a slight pinch somewhere. As long as that's not a serious issue, that's a sigh of relief for Texas, I think. So we'll see when Texas gets Madden back. Obviously, that would be a huge blow if he's out for a significant period of time, because he's been really, really good, even without his elite velocity this year. We'll see what happens with him moving forward. But if Texas can avoid a big injury there, that would really help its pitching staff in the days ahead. And its pitching staff is going to be tested Tuesday and Wednesday by Arkansas. Arkansas is 17-2. Yeah, it's a good team. It's not as good as a team that nearly won the College World Series if it was not for a drop fly ball in foul territory. But at the top of their order, they're as good as anybody in the country with Heston Kjerstad and then Casey Martin. I mean, Casey Martin is a freak, man. I know his numbers are a little down this season, but I saw Dave Seifert from PBR had him, like, I think 3-9 down the line the other day, which for a right-handed batter is like Trout-like. That is just freaking absurd. So he's one of the best players in the country. Arkansas can really, really hit. You know, they're slugging .457 as a team, .394 on base. And, you know, the guy they're throwing tonight, Patrick Wicklander, 29 strikeouts and 18 and a third with a .150 batting average against. So he's pretty good based on the statistics. This is going to be a tough situation for Texas, especially with the way that it used all of those arms in Sunday's game and the way they've been kind of struggling to find some confidence at the plate. I think the if Texas can get a split out of this, I would consider that a win for Texas. And really, the reality is these are really nice opportunities to pick up resume building wins. But what happens on the weekends matters the most. You are judged ultimately by your series victories. And right now, Texas has series victories over LSU, Texas Tech, at Louisiana, and Purdue. That's a really, really good start to the season as relates to the NCAA tournament. And if you look at some of the projected RPI numbers right now, I think Texas Tech is top 5 in RPI. I think LSU is going to end the season. I think they're like top 30 right now, but they're going to move up the list. Stanford is top 5 in RPI right now. So the strength of schedule for Texas is going to take care of itself and be really good. So these midweek games, just keep in mind, Texas had to, you know, do whatever it needed to do to get what matters most last weekend, which was a series victory over Texas Tech. And this Arkansas team is good. I haven't looked to see where they are in the polls specifically. Speaking of Texas, I wrote this down and did mention it. They're up to number 9 at D1Baseball.com and they're top 25 and number 4 at Baseball America. I do not think Texas is the number 4 team in the country. I think you can make a case if you're going purely off resume, like what kind of wins have you played and what kind of schedule you have. You can maybe make a case that Texas has the number 4 resume in the country, but this is not a top 5 baseball team. I think number 9 is a much more fair value. Because it does factor in this team is generating quality results, but it isn't a slam dunk, you know, top 5 team in terms of talent and production and things like that. So I should have looked beforehand where Arkansas was in the standings. I apologize for that. But I am just assuming that I could probably look it up here pretty quickly. I am just assuming that they are like a top 10, top 15-ish team. I mean, we're talking about a team that did bring back some key pieces coming off of a trip to the final games of the College World Series. Yeah, they're number 11, number 11 at D1Baseball.com. So a really good baseball team. Shockingly, Texas is playing another team that's really, really good in like the top 10 or top 15. It seems like every game is against one of those teams. So that puts the Longhorns in perspective. We're going to switch gears here. Like I said, I want to talk some about Mike Trout, and I've rambled a lot already. This might be a little bit longer of a podcast that I'm used to, but the news broke today. Mike Trout, 12-year, $430 million extension with the Angels. Why did he do it? If you read a lot about Mike Trout, he is a guy that's he really values, you know, the comfort, the familiarity. He's just kind of a different guy in that regard. You know, seeing the same people every day, being in, you know, the same routine every day. Just, I've got my roots established here. You know, he truly is a guy from a small town in New Jersey that just really, really loves playing baseball. You know, he loves being in the situation that he's in, which is fortunate for the Angels, because I think a vast majority of guys in this situation, I mean, the Angels haven't had much success. He could have waited until after the 2020 season to become a free agent and probably received a deal something like 10 or 11 years for like, I don't know, $450 million. I think he could have definitely earned more money than he will with this extension, but he's just a different guy, and he likes the situation he's in. And I think that, you know, the Angels are able to capitalize on that. And of course it helps when you're going to get paid $430 million over 12 years, which is a record in sports. But he's just a comfort factor for Mike Trout. You know, he's the best player in baseball, and he kind of stays out of the spotlight some. He's just kind of this guy that he is who he is. He likes playing baseball. He goes about his business, and you know, that's about it. So that's a situation he wanted to be in. And I do think it's interesting too. Joel Sherman, a New York Post longtime MLB columnist, tweeted this out. Like, you know, from observing Trout in spring training, you could tell that he has like a really special interest in some of the up-and-coming prospects with the Angels, because the Angels finally have a farm system that's turning around. And I think Sherman used a quote that, you know, Trout would sometimes text his general manager and say, hey, did you see this guy did this in the box score tonight in this minor league game or something like that. So he clearly feels positive about where the Angels roster is going moving forward, and some of the young talent they're developing. And, you know, that young talent being able to eventually graduate and support him. So I think that that was a big part of why he ultimately decided to stay there, as well as the comfort and things like that. And I thought he would flirt with the idea of Philly and you know, as a Philly guy and going back home and all those things. But truly, he's just a guy that, you know, he's comfortable where he is. He wants to stay where he is. He likes that comfort, and he's going to get paid a lot of money to stay there. Although it wouldn't quite been the amount of money that he would have made if he'd gone into the free agent market. Why is he worth it? Well, it's pretty simple. He's the best player in baseball. He's been the best player in baseball for a while. And, you know, Fangraphs.com assigns a, you know, each player a value based on their WAR, wins above replacement, and based on the market and how it values WAR and all of those things. So for this past season, basically 1.0 WAR equals about $8 million. So this past season, based on the year that Mike Trout had, he was worth $78.6 million. In his career, he's already been worth $494 million already. That's incredible. So why is he worth it? Well, you're gonna get some good bang for the buck here with Mike Trout. He's 27 years old. You know, the history of baseball has told us the prime of these guys is around age 28. So he's just now entering the prime of his career, technically. And, you know, I came across a tweet from Patrick Brennan on Twitter, at Painting the Corner, or at Painting Corner. You know, he does a lot of things for Royals Farm, and he does some writing for Beyond the Box Score as well, which is a cool cool Twitter account and cool baseball website that does some analysis type pieces. So he went through and he did a, he says, with a normal aging curve performance and inflation taken into consideration, the Mike Trout contract extension looks like a joke. His play is projected to be worth over $1 billion the next 12 years. That's roughly a $700 million surplus. So if you factor in the normal decline based on his production and age, so, you know, you'd say that once he gets out of his prime, which I think will probably extend from, you know, keep extending until he's probably 33, maybe 34 as well. So if you factor in the normal decline for age relative to production, all those things, you factor in inflation, the value of, you know, a win for a player, like, you know, the 1.0 WAR and things like that, It's, I mean, this deal could look like a steal in terms of value. If he just keeps the production that he's had over the last seven seasons and you project it out over the next seven seasons of his deal and you don't even factor in inflation in the change in the value of dollars per war, per one war, even if you don't adjust for those things, he'd be worth like $520 million over the next 7 years. Which, so, like, this brings me to a larger discussion point about, you know, how fans view these deals and things like that. Like, so much of the initial reaction on Orange Bloods, and I spent way too much time posting in this thread and trying to explain it, and it's just, it's maddening. Like, the people view these deals, and they think, oh, you know, he's not going to worth it. He's not going to be worth it. And there are examples of that. You know, the Albert Pujols deal is going to get thrown in the face of the Angels. And a lot of people are going to use that as, you know, a signal to say, hey, look, you know, this is why. Well, Albert Pujols is not Mike Trout. The deal was not the same in terms of, you know, the age and the production and all those things. But I get it. Okay, you're looking at the Pujols deal and saying, yeah, you know, that sucks. But the value of this deal comes from the individual player production. It doesn't, like, everybody's like, oh, you know, they're going to sacrifice winning to pay Mike Trout. That's not how this works. In the grand scheme of things, his how many dollars he costs relative to their salary or whatever, however you want to phrase it, is just not that big of a percentage. And if he is worth more than his contract is paying him, I don't understand how that can be viewed as a negative. If he's producing more value than he's paid, that would suggest that the Angels are getting a good deal out of this. And if Mike Trout is just Mike Trout or similar to Mike Trout for the next six or seven seasons, the deal's already going to be worth it, regardless of what happens the rest of his career. I just feel like fans, for some reason, when they see these deals, they have such a hard time not putting team success with the individual deal together, like the two are married. And but when in reality, the only way they're married is if the guy produces on the field relative to what he's being paid. If he's producing at the value he's being paid or more, that can't negatively influence the team. I just, fans see these deals and they're like, oh, okay, well, they're not going to be able to build around him because they're paying him so much money. But in reality, that's just not the case. These owners, it's truly mystifying that fans want to support the owners. They want to carry the owner's water. Oh, you know, this is going to really hinder the, you know, this franchise's ability to go sign more players, you know, and this and that. And they're not going to be able to build around him because they're paying him so much money. These owners are billionaires. Billionaires turning huge profits in revenue every single season. They're billionaires, and they're only going to continue to make more money as there are more TV deals and more MLB, you know, the media stuff. And all of these things, owners are going to keep making money. They're going to keep making more money. The revenue has increased over and over and over again constantly. You know, take Artie Moreno, for example, who owns the Angels. Artie Moreno, you want to know what he bought the team for in 2003? So 15, 16 years ago, Artie Moreno bought the Angels for $183.5 million. It's a lot of money. The Angels are now worth $1.8 billion. $1.8 billion. He bought the entire team for, like, you know, a fraction of what Mike Trout just signed his deal for. I don't think Artie Moreno is struggling financially. He's worth $3 billion. According to Forbes, the Angels made $334 million in revenue last year. And I don't know if that factors in MLB revenue sharing or TV deals or all those sorts of things. I mean, this guy is in Los Angeles. He's going to have a really nice television contract, especially now the fact that he's locked up the best guy in baseball for the next 12 seasons. It blows my mind that these fans want to act like these owners are some poor guys or that they're not turning a profit. These guys are big time businessmen. They buy these organizations for a reason. It's not to have a toy to treat as fantasy baseball. It's to make money. And I guarantee you, they wouldn't be buying these organizations if it wasn't a good investment. Because look, in 15 or 16 years, Artie Moreno took a team that he paid $183.5 million for in Los Angeles, and it's now worth $1.8 billion. I would say business is going pretty good for Artie Moreno, just as it is many of these Major League Baseball teams. You know, the Pirates are an example. I follow the Pirates very, very closely. The Pirates reportedly had a revenue of like $255 million last year. Their payroll entering this season is like $70 million. The Major League Players Association actually just filed a grievance against teams like the Pirates, Rays, I think the A's might have been in that as well, and one other team for not spending their revenue sharing money the right way. Basically like, hey, we can see that you're not spending the money you got from revenue sharing. The Pirates can't go out and add a Mike Trout. Bullshit! The Pirates could add two Mike Trouts if they wanted to. They can make two of those types of commitments. They're not struggling. You know, the Pirates were purchased in 1996 I'd have to go look it up, but it's something low. You know, I think it was like $98 or $96 million in 1996. And this is when the Pirates were good. You know, they had some success. Guys like Barry Bonds and Bobby Bonilla and Andy Van Slyke and Doug Drabeck. I mean, they were playing for championships back then. So they were purchased then, and they're now worth like $1.2 billion. These owners are not struggling. And maybe the most perplexing thing about all of this and the way the fans want to just, you know, feel bad for these owners. And, oh, the poor owner. This team's not going to be able to spend any money around this guy. And keep in mind the luxury tax threshold is like $200 million. And the Angels still have $36 million in free space before they even meet that point. The only thing that hinders the owner's spending truly is the luxury tax and their own penny pinching. Either they want to spend money or they don't. It's not that because they have a lack of money. But maybe the most maddening thing about all of this is when these fans come to support these owners and, oh, this guy's getting too much. Like, the team will never survive because of this deal, even though he's the best player in baseball and might end up being statistically the best baseball player ever. Keep in mind, fans, that some of these owners that are billionaires, that are making hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue at least every single season off these teams that they buy because they're good, safe business moves, and they're only going to keep making more money. Keep in mind also that some of these owners are getting you to pay for their stadiums. They're not even, in some cases, they're not even paying for their stadiums. These new, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars stadiums that are being built across baseball. They're not even having to finance those. They're getting the city to finance those. They're getting the fans to pay for the stadiums. And these guys are making billions of dollars. These guys are worth billions. B, as in billions, not millions, billions. So excuse me if I don't feel bad, because some owner's got to spend this much money on Mike Trout. They've got plenty of money. The Angels could go out and sign another Mike Trout contract if they wanted to. The money's not the issue. The business is great in baseball. It's going to continue to be great. They do a great job with MLB Advanced Media and MLB TV, which, by the way, when it started, the owners collectively invested in that, and it now makes something like $1 billion a year. Like, they're getting a bunch of revenue sharing stuff. Look at some of these TV contracts that they're signing, these regional TV deals, because as we know, while baseball isn't as popular nationally as things like football, it's a very popular regional sport. You could turn on your TV 162 times a year if you live in that city's market or that team's market and watch your team. 162 times that's on your television. Think about all of the revenue TVs can generate from that, all of these things. So yeah, they're going to pay these teams a lot of money to broadcast their games, especially when they're teams that have guys like Mike Trout, and especially when they're in areas like Los Angeles. So it mystifies me that fans just want to run to support owners about these big contracts. The owners are making a ton of money. The owners are doing just fine. Even all of the owners, even the teams that don't spend, are doing just fine. Business in baseball is really, really good. I think only one team is not valued over $1 billion, and I think that's the Rays, who are valued at something like $900 million. So these owners have plenty of money to spend. And sure, you know, they can't, you know, they can't have $300 million salaries. At some point, the luxury tax is going to kick them in the ass to a point to where that tax is a payment that owners don't want to make. But they've got plenty of money. The Padres have plenty of money to use if they want to sign another Manny Machado or surround guys with them, surround Machado with guys. The Angels have a ton of money to use, which they have used. The problem with the Angels isn't that they don't have money. It's that they haven't spent it the best way, you know, with some of their deals. So the Angels are going to spend money. They're going to add around Mike Trout. They're going to go out in free agency eventually and spend a lot of money. They're going to throw a lot of resources into their farm system and their international signings and all those things to try to best surround Mike Trout with a team that could win the championship. It really just comes down to whether they do those things the correct way or not. Are the moves they make successful or not? That really determines the success because, I mean, basically half of Major League Baseball is going to spend over, you know, $130 million or more on payroll this year. So while you do have the outliers like the Red Sox and the Cubs and the Yankees that are spending a lot of money, the Angels are fifth in payroll at like 168 or something like that. So while you have these outliers at the very top that do spend a ton of money, a lot of these teams are spending, you know, easily over $100 million in payroll each year with the ability to go up even more. I mean, the business of baseball is treating owners extremely well. So if, you know, if you're as a fan and the first thing you think of when you see Mike Trout agree to a deal like that is, oh, this team doesn't, it's not going to be able to go out and get any other guys. That's simply not the case. It's a matter of whether they want to go get those guys. And when they do, if they do, what kind of players are they acquiring and do they make good moves? That's ultimately what it comes down to. Because otherwise, it's either not wanting to pay the luxury tax, which I get, which by the way is projected to be $210 million in 2021 season. So, I mean, basically, you can spend what you want for the most part. It's either going to get down to whether the owner wants to spend or not and the luxury tax. That's really the only things that prevent these owners who are making so much money off these franchises. That's the only things that prevent them from going out and spending a bunch of money on players. So stop feeling bad for the owners. Stop. The same owners that could turn around into your city and make you pay for their stadiums while they have these franchises that are worth, you know, in some cases, well over $2 billion. Stop feeling bad for them. They're making a ton of money. They're only going to make more money. The business of baseball has never been better. I know some people like, oh, baseball is dying because of its popularity or whatnot. Well, guess what? In terms of financial popularity, it is doing extremely well, and that's not going to stop anytime soon. So stop feeling bad for these owners and stop looking at a deal like Mike Trout and saying, oh, is it worth it for the Angels to have, you know, this good player when they can't do anything else? Well, guess what? If Mike Trout outperforms what he's being paid, that's a good deal for the Angels. And the chances are very, very good that Mike Trout is going to outperform that. So what's the downside of paying the best player in baseball less money than he's worth? The Angels, are the Angels a better team or a worse team with Mike Trout, regardless of salary, especially if he's performing better than what he's paid? Are they a worse team or they're a better team? They're a better team. Okay. Well, you know, the total wins. Like, the Angels aren't going to be able to win a lot of games because they're paying Mike Trout so much money. Well, if Mike Trout is contributing so much to winning each year and he's actually a bargain relative to his contract, isn't that a good thing? It's time to don't look at these deals as combining them to team success. Is the individual player worth that? Is he going to be worth more than he's going to be paid? That's what you have to keep in mind. Is he contributing on the field to winning, especially relative to his contract? If he is, it's a good deal. There's really no downside to it because these owners have a ton of money to spend. They have a luxury tax that's going to be $210 million in a couple of years. Stop feeling sorry for them and stop looking at these deals like Mike Trout, like, oh, okay, well, that's the one big contract the Angels can have. No, the Angels do have other big contracts. They just need to be smarter with this new front office, smarter about when they spend their money, how they spend their money, and be more accurate in spending that money so they can elevate the team around Mike Trout. Because baseball, more so than any other sport, like, one guy can be really, really, really good, but it's a 162-game season with a soon-to-be 26-man roster. And there's pitching, there's defense, there's hitting, and there's a lot of factors that go into it beyond just one individual player. But if you've got the best player in baseball, and he's going to be worth way more than what you're paying him, that is good for that team. And with that, we'll wrap up this edition of the Extra Bases Podcast on theyak.com. I'm Dustin McComas from orangebloods.com. Episode 33 in the books. Stop feeling bad for these owners. Stop. They're making tons of money. They're billionaires. They're turning insane, you know, revenues each year in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And they're going to only make more. And they're going to have more TV deals. And they're going to have more radio deals. And they're going to get more revenue sharing money for Major League Baseball. So stop feeling bad for the owners. And as for the Longhorns, this team competes. It competes. It competes. And it's 15-7 right now. And it's about to be – it's basically – 1 week away from being through its true gauntlet of a schedule. I mean, you look at after the two Arkansas midweek games, go on the road and face a top 25 TCU team who has probably the best starting rotation in the Big 12, but has been struggling at times offensively. And then after that, Incarnate Ward, a three-game sit against Xavier. Of course, the big midweek, golly, it would help if a guy with a podcast could talk at times. A big midweek game against Texas A&M, then a series at Baylor. But really, I mean, after the TCU, it lets up a little bit. Of course, Baylor will be tough, but they're without Cody Bradford now. Then you get into a midweek against Rice. Then there's Kansas State, Oklahoma State, West Virginia, Kansas, Oklahoma to finish the season. So Texas is almost through this gauntlet. And if it can split the Arkansas midweek and then, you know, somehow win a series at TCU – that would be just an enormous amount of success for Texas heading in to when the schedule lets up and really a terrific start to their season. So let's wrap it up. That's Extra Bases, episode 33. I've gone a little longer than normal. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope I explained where the Longhorns are. I hope I explained all of my thoughts on Mike Trout. Yes, I'm biased about Mike Trout, but statistically, you can't deny the value. You can't deny that he's the best player in baseball. You can't deny that if he continues to perform at a similar level over the next six or seven seasons, his contract is already going to be worth it. And just stop feeling bad for these owners who are billionaires who have plenty of money to spend. All right, I'm out. Have a good week. Take care.